Hello, this is Paul Check, and I'd like to welcome you to yet another one of our excellent PPS Success Mastery interviews. Today, I'm introducing a new PPS Success Mastery mentor, Jerry Pape. Jerry has been a friend of mine and has been managing the technology for the Check Institute for 10 years now. And Jerry is one of those rare people that you become fortunate enough to meet along the way. And when you meet somebody who offers you many ways to improve your business and to make things easier, immediately you value that person. And when we meet a person like that, it's very, very natural for us to want to get to know them better, to see what makes them tick. Because we know that to the degree that they can influence the efficiency of our technology and our business, they've influenced our lives to that very degree. And because all of us exist as personal realities, professional realities, and spiritual realities, there's a natural seamlessness that we experience if we open ourselves to it. In the 10 years I've known Jerry Pape, to say that he has been a marvel to me would be an understatement. The most intelligent woman I've ever met in my life, I married. The most intelligent man I can honestly say that I know is somebody who's as smart as my wife, and my wife readily admits Jerry Pape's vast intelligence. Jerry, it's a pleasure to interview you as a PPS Success Mastery Program mentor, and I'm excited to be able to share more about you and what you can offer the PPS students as a mentor. So welcome to your first PPS Success Mastery interview.
Well, thanks so much for giving me this opportunity to talk with the very interesting group of individuals that you've been assisting in moving down this path that we call life. I knew when I met you 10 years ago at one of your golf clinics, I was there then with a girlfriend of mine who was getting certified in that you had a unique ability, and I am not at all surprised that over the intervening decade it has blossomed into so many things that can be so helpful to people who are ready and willing to be helped. I hope that I will be able to be a contributor to this and a worthy contributor to these individuals who are really motivated to align their lives, find their purposes, and achieve their goals.
Well, thanks, Jerry. And one of the things I wanted to do to begin the interview is give people a little bit more information about you. You know, my experience of you is vast, and because of our friendship, it goes way beyond just the services that the Institute pays you to offer us with regards to information systems management and technology management. But I would love it if maybe you could just give a short description of what it is that you do and some of the experiences and academic pursuits you've been through so that you could be the person that is now being recruited as a PPS mentor.
I'd be happy to tell you a little bit about that. It's not your usual story. There's no question about that. And you're probably familiar with some of that.
Yeah.
I began life in Chicago. Some would jokingly say that I was dropped off or I landed. And that's been a continuing theme or joke throughout the course of my existence. And at that point, my parents, having had a very successful business and a lot of affiliations in that area, decided that they wanted to move to the country. And boy, did they go way out into the country. We ended up in a place called Big Sky, Montana. Big Sky wasn't necessarily the ultimate selection, but what happened was the camper broke down there. My father's father, my grandfather's camper, broke down at the entrance to the Big Sky Ski Resort before it had opened in 1972. My parents were very well treated by the people who were developing the resort and decided that that was where they were going to buy the home and move the family. And they moved the family there in 1973, and we began the usual course of integrating into life somewhere else. I grew up in a place that didn't have streetlights, didn't have paved streets, didn't have stoplights, Didn't get cable for quite a while, but it was an interesting existence. It was always safe to turn your kids out to play wherever they happened to be, as long as there wasn't a moose in the yard, and that happened pretty often, too. But you met a lot of interesting people because it was a very popular ski resort at the time. So we as kids had a very active, athletic early life. You know, you'd be skiing every weekend, and the local elementary school would turn you out to ski on Fridays. So it was a very interesting experience. But there were a few things that were problematic. As a young man, I had some inherent health problems. I had been a diabetic since I was about 10 years old. And in looking at what was available in education in that area, it was extraordinarily limited. And my parents had to really persevere to having a child who had a brain that was, well, not a lot like everyone else's. And the school systems just really weren't capable of managing much there. And so I ended up in a private school for a period of time that was designed to prepare me for a different academic experience. And in that interim, I ended up in university-level education very early on. I was first introduced to university-level education as part of a special program when I was about 12 years old.
Wow, that's crazy. I've never heard of that before.
It was a pretty different situation. It was very, it pleased me. I was very happy with it. And subsequent to that, there was some more private education. And then after that, I ended up going through sort of the usual, which colleges do you apply for, and so on and so forth some years later. There was a period of time where I wasn't involved in education. I was just working. I worked in a ski shop and learned how to have a variety of good and bad habits in that scenario, and enjoyed the skiing and the snow bunnies and things like that. That was always good. But at some point, you had to go out into the world. And I ended up taking my next step into the world after that to Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, where I began both as a student and not long thereafter as a teacher. I taught applied physics in the applied physics department under a professor there who ran the observatory, and I in turn inherited responsibility for managing that along with a couple of other of that professor's students for a period of several years. Simultaneously, I was involved in the computer science department and in particular in the network infrastructure department at Stanford with the people who ran those budgets. And so my job was to try to create what we would call computing in the residential environments. We were bringing in the first PCs, as it were, to student residences so that students could do their work without having to go to the library or what have you. This is predating the era of laptop computers and personal computers and so on. And so we built a lot of that networking and created those the ability for students to do that work more conveniently at that time. Subsequent to university, I had been involved in an illness. The illness is the illness of real estate practice. It's a disease you get from your parents. And my parents owned their real estate practice in Montana. That's what they did when they came to Montana from Chicago. And I had been involved in that for some time. And out in California, I continued in that particular practice from the end of my college years or close to the present day. And one of the things that we did for people who were in that environment was that I had really wanted to go into real estate there to help real estate people figure out what to do with technology, much as I had done for my family. The problem was that the realtors in this environment were very successful, very powerful real estate people who didn't believe anybody, who didn't understand their business. And I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to get through to these people if I'm not one of them. So at that time, I undertook to get my licensure and so on and go through a very grueling process of education and receiving the mentorship of some of the greatest real estate agents alive today, people who are, you know, number one in their profession in the state of California or number three in the whole world in volume sales. And they taught me vast amounts. They taught me a university's career of knowledge about business practice and things like that. And in turn, I was able to help them optimize what they were doing in technology because it was where they were really faltering. They were really people, and technology was a mystery to them. And so we created a relationship that was very beneficial and to this day is still used by a lot of those individuals. I had then entered into an arena of computer training for a variety of different educational institutions. At that time, I taught for, after teaching for Stanford, I taught for the University of California, Santa Cruz for several years. I then taught for San Jose State for a period of time, a little bit for Foothill College in California. After that period of time, we had been involved in software development in a number of different areas. We've been involved in the development of things like the Palm Pilot, the what is today the Dymo label printer, which just about everybody has one of, and so on. I was doing these things simultaneously, but it's hard to explain that in a phone interview that we were both running the technology business and the real estate or the training businesses sort of at the same time. I had a lot of energy as a younger man and felt that I could benefit the most people by focusing on the things that I was good at, and there just happened to be a fair number of them. And so we did a lot of that. We produced a lot of software products and spent a lot of time, especially in the Macintosh arena. I was one of the first Mac salespeople in the country before I went to college in California. I spent about a year in Chicago at that time with some other family members. And we've been continuously Mac users since that period of time. But we support a vast array of Windows-based PC users throughout the country as well. So now it's probably the time to explain how the businesses are divided. I own Excalibur, which is an IT management and business continuity firm, which specializes in helping companies maintain cost-effective IT infrastructures and to know how to be resilient in the event that those infrastructures have problems or fail, which they will do. It's not a question of if, it's just a question of when. So we try to create continuity in a business. One example of this would have been the fires that have now twice struck the San Diego area and on both occasions affected the Czech Institute. The most recent fire came very close to jeopardizing the building, and we produced a means by which all of your data could be protected in that environment, which is very important for today's intellectual property companies, companies that make videos and audios and books and all of this publishing and the things that the Institute and PPS do. So that was one of the areas where we were able to really help people. The other side of our company today is a real estate brokerage, which is predominantly centered in Montana, in the Bozeman and Big Sky areas of southwestern Montana. The technology business serves clients well from down where you're at in San Diego, Paul, up through San Francisco to other parts of the West Coast and on through into the Rocky Mountains in Montana. And we have been able to do that very successfully and cost-effectively because one of the hallmarks of my personal career was involvement in what they call the remote management of technology. It allows me to take care of computer problems all over the country without having to physically be present in about 90% of the cases. It's something that lets people sleep a little easier at night. So those are some of the things that we've been about up until this point. I eventually ended up with a degree from Stanford after 5 years and a variety of other pursuits, including some time in the nightclub business in the San Francisco Bay Area, with a degree in science and technology. The actual department was values, science, technology, and society. And the only other department like that was at MIT at the time. And today it's now called STS, Science, Technology, and Society. And our job with that particular degree and experience was to be the middleman between the non-technological person and the people who created technology to help them be more successful together. And so that was a little bit of what I've been about over the course of the last 20 or 30 years.
And that's all very, very interesting. And one element I would love if you could just expand briefly on, because it's going to be a necessary step to the interview questions I have for you. There's another side to you which, as a customer of yours and a friend of yours, is as powerful and as apparent to anyone that works with you as the technology knowledge and skill you have, and that is your Buddhist practice and your spiritual practice. Could you give the people listening an opportunity to know just a little bit about the inside of Jerry and how that's developed?
I would be happy to. I would like to emphasize at the outset of that that I have looked at the Buddhist path. Spirituality is not path constrained. What I mean to say is the important part of what has to happen in our lives to handle the various things that life throws at us is not which spirituality you've chosen. It's simply that you've chosen some spirituality. The understanding or the old statement that we are spiritual beings enjoying a physical existence is probably not very far from the truth. And what brought me to this very early on was some feelings that I've had since I was about 13 or 14 years old about how we had ought to try to interact with and conduct ourselves with others. I was always interested in finding a path of achieving mutual benefit. And, you know, at that time in American business, in Western business, everything was pretty much about seek and destroy. When you were selling someone something, get the highest price for it. When you were buying something from someone, get the lowest price for it. Well, as an aside, there's a very interesting note in looking at a thing called game theory, which is based on the idea of two parties independently making choices in a business-type world. It's been discovered that the equilibrium point for those parties, the point where they both do as well as they could, is something that requires collaboration. It is no longer the world of trying to create these very uneven relationships. And that's something that has been of great interest to me since I was very young. And as I was undertaking in my early college career a study of sort of religious practices, a survey of religion, if you will, I came across the Buddhist path for the second time. And I looked at it and thought, wow, these guys seem to be thinking the same things I'm thinking. And it was a very natural path for me. I looked at it and said, oh, okay, I get it. No real issue here. It wasn't something I changed to or converted to. And what was more important was that the thing that interested me about it most, Paul, was that the Buddhists, in particular the Tibetan Buddhists, are most widely acknowledged in the modern world by Nobel laureates and scientists and so on as people who have developed as practitioners of understanding the mind. As an entirely separate aspect from whatever their religious pursuit is, these people have great capability for expanding one's attention span, for creating a more directable, more useful state of mind. And that was the thing that interested me tremendously. Because as a person who was doing as many things as I was doing, the last thing you needed to do was have a mind that was making things harder for you. And so I felt that we needed to really look at that. And over the intervening years, it has become a great part of my life and a very rewarding one, in large part because of one thing. When one works with Buddhism, it's said that one practices Buddhism. And that's really the key thing. It's a practice. You do it over and over so you get better at it. You can't expect instantaneous circumstances or change in anything. For example, in PPS, one has to be committed. One has to be committed to practicing and observing and repeating. The rinse and repeat idea is really important. And one of the things about our society, Western society in particular, is that we miss the idea that in order to get into the cycle of practice, rinse, and repeat, you have to also be very patient. You have to be very persistent because nothing that's really valuable generally comes instantaneously. And so for me, in looking at the spiritual practice and the understanding of these things, it's provided me with a foundation to return to when life becomes crazy, when it's difficult to manage multiple businesses or to aid other people, and to manage, you know, some of the health issues that come with diabetes for 30 years or what have you. These things are very complicated, and I would not have been lucky enough to get through them if I didn't have a strong basis and a strong set of guides in what we would call today mind training. I would close with that idea that one of the things that is very interesting about this, or the science of it, is that a vast array of notable scientists in our world, from neuroscience to theoretical physics to particle physics, these people have a greater than 10-year history with the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a seminar they call Mind and Life, which is predominantly these individuals interacting with some of the leading mind training experts of the Tibetan Buddhist path and realizing that it's very important to work with these people and understand what they've learned. And you might ask yourself, well, why them? The reality is pretty simple. At 20-plus thousand feet, there weren't a lot of raw resources and a great deal of science and other things going on for these people. So instead of becoming great physicians and orthopedic surgeons and circuit-making engineering design characters, they went inside. and they spent several hundred years working with the Mayans, which has created a very interesting perspective for them, and one that can provide for people who are interested in it some stability in moving through the complicated aspects of our world. I would close again with this idea. Unlike other things, Buddhist practice is not something that requires you to select a religion or abandon the religion or spiritual practice that perhaps came from your parents to you or that you've practiced throughout the course of your life. There are a vast array of people who are adherent Jewish Judaic practitioners who are Zen Buddhist practitioners. There are a vast array of other people who, from Catholic monks to people who are in other traditions of religious practice, who are engaging in dialogue and adopting some of these mind training practices to help them focus, to help them achieve greater compassion, to help them achieve better relationships and things of this nature. And that has been a really big factor for me, is to find out how we produce a path of mutual benefit. I will say that this was brought to me in a very apt way by Gyaltso Rinpoche, one of the eminent Tibetan practitioners, a very old and wise character, who in his sort of broken English once looked at me and said, the two things you have to be concerned with are, what is benefit, who is benefit? For every action that we take, we have to consider these two things. And what I learned from this is that if I'm choosing choices wherein the only beneficiary is me, I am not working hard enough. And it does mean that there's more work involved. It's a lot harder to make the decisions that will benefit you and other, self and other, but in some ways it's the only way that I believe we're going to continue to improve both ourselves and this world. And that's sort of my idea in a nutshell.
Well, that really nicely leads to my first interview question. You know, there's, in my work, which as you know is predominantly coaching either world-class or elite amateur athletes in improving their performance, or working with people that have problems with addiction, eating disorders, or diseases, and that would include musculoskeletal conundrums such as disc injuries and, you know, classic orthopedic disorders. One of the main things that I see as an etiology for people's pain and stress is that they're what I call highly externalized. They identify themselves as what they do. They identify themselves to others by the cars they drive, the brand of phone they use. In other words, what I see over and over and over again is that our society has produced a sense of success that is displayed in your purchasability, applicability, and use of various technologies. Yet, I found over and over again that the more so-called successful people are, the more likely they are to suffer what I would refer to as a disease of division. In studying Rudolf Steiner's work for many years, one of the things that Steiner talks about and makes very, very clear, and I believe this is a relevant discussion with you, is Steiner says that as spiritual beings who have chosen to take on a physical existence, one of the things that happens is we lose our true sense of ourself, our spiritual self, and sometimes in metaphysics they call it drinking from the river of forgetfulness. In other words, we forget our past lives, we forget our true spiritual nature, and we are sort of born into this drunken sense that there really is nothing but this body, this self, and that with that consciousness comes a greater sense of self through accumulation. So the person who has five houses and three Porsches and a Bentley has the false impression that they're actually more of someone than someone who has no house and no car. Steiner described clearly that the path that human beings are going through is cyclical in that they will externalize their internal technology to the point at which the technology that they externalize divides them so much and divides the world so much that they literally destroy the world and themselves. He describes how the Western world today, with its advanced technology, will become the equivalent of India, and India and these undeveloped countries will go through a cycle of yin converting to yang, and they will become the next industrial giants. The point that I wanted to share your perspective on is Steiner literally says every single thing we can create or will create is only a representative technology for what exists inside of us. Working with business systems, advanced computer technology, real estate, money exchange, information technologies like you do, have you yourself come to see or experience that really all these motherboards, circuit boards, and systems are really just reflecting things inside of us? And have you observed that, to quote a saying, there's an old saying that I read somewhere which I really love, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. So what I'm really asking you is, do you observe that if people get themselves into too many technological, social, or cultural pursuits, that the more they gain, the more they seem to lose the inner self?
Paul, I think it's an excellent question. And in returning to the thoughts of Steiner and sort of anthroposophy, which was a central notion of his, I think that there are two things that drive humanity. Whether we repress that or we express it, one of them is, why are we here? The quest for knowledge, the nature of thinking, and the nature of extending reach. The funny thing about technology is that initial technology came up as a way of optimizing some process. For example, you were scraping the skin of something, or you were walking around with a stick and thought, this really isn't the best spear in the world. You were trying to create something that you visualized in your mind or that you saw an example of in nature and trying to recreate that and turn it into something, from stone tools to pneumatic nail guns. Now, it's all about putting something in your hand or extending something from your mind. So returning to the central element of your question, absolutely. All technology is an extension of processes, concepts, things that are inside the human mind. And the problem with technology that does work, and the evidence of technology, problem with technology that doesn't work, and the evidence of technology that does, per se, is a question of how well somebody expressed what they had in their mind, how well it was expressed so that other minds could instantaneously understand it. This is what we call intuitive technology, what differentiated the Mac operating system from the early operating systems of other computers, was that it was very intuitive. You saw the trash can, you knew what it was for. If you pick up a really good hammer, you know, today they've got form-fitting, articulated, vibration-absorbing hammers. You try that out for a day as a professional framing carpenter, and you try out one of these old ones and go, wow, somebody really made something great here. How did that come about? It came about because somebody envisioned trying to use mental processes to make a better tool or to achieve a better result. And where we run into trouble is that many times in today's world of productization, branding, consumer orientation, we, instead of improving our technology, simply try to make it look different. We try to satisfy the ego of the end user by allowing them to make a phone that has leopard spots on it, or is red or green or blue or purple, but it's all the same phone. And really, in the long run, you would find that more people would be satisfied if they had to make a choice, choosing a vanilla-looking phone that worked more appropriately or more intuitively or was more powerful than whether or not it had all sorts of different colors and whizzy little things on it that don't really contribute to its function. People have lost some of the central idea of what technology is supposed to do for you. And many people would argue that lots of technologies actually make things harder because they aren't well designed. So they're put into place. I'll tell you a little story about how I came to do what I did at Stanford. because I came to the university with certain knowledge of things like astronomy and computer science that were, well, frankly, way ahead of where most other people were when they entered as freshmen, I found that one day I went into a department to request a syllabus for a course that I was thinking of taking. And I found this attractive young woman behind the desk in the office of the professor in tears. And I thought, wow, what's this all about? And she said, we got these new computers as part of a grant, as did many of these other departments, and nobody knows how to use them. And my professor has put it on this desk, and I'm supposed to do all these things with it, and I don't get it. And I thought, okay, here's an opportunity. And what I realized was that the university itself, as advanced as it was, wasn't prepared for the personal computer revolution. They had no departments. They had no staff to support anyone in this. So one of the first businesses that I entered into was the business of supporting those various departments that I was affiliated with from an IT perspective, in particular teaching them how to use the systems so that they could get the syllabuses out and not be bursting into tears in the 11th hour, and so on. Well, what that tells you about a little bit here is that in many instances, people buy an idea but don't consider its ramifications. They don't look at consequence with respect to results in technology. Another area that directly relates to the idea of what's inside and how we turn it into technology is this understanding of how we evaluate benefit with technology. I often say this, in your business, Paul, as an extraordinarily fit human being, if you go out and buy a weight set and you use it and you use it to train other people, it's considered an asset that's going to make money for you. It's a money-producing technology. So the amount of money you should spend on your weight set should somehow be proportional to the amount of money you think you're going to make from having that advantage or that technology. In my business, in the IT business, if somebody comes out with a new great laptop, Apple releases a new laptop, it costs $5,000, I'll buy it without even thinking about it because I know that my technology multiplier is at 10. I will make at least $50,000 on that device in pure profit from assisting other people. But the problem with most people is they don't know what their technology multiplier number is. It's certainly not 10 unless they're in my business, but it has to be some number. It's got to be better than 1. So in any given business, if the technology becomes the central nervous system of the business, of all the transactions, all the money, all the QuickBooks information, accounting, accounts receivable, accounts payable, flow through this system, it must have some integral value to the organization as a multiplier. One way to test this idea as a mind experiment is just to imagine what would happen if you took it away. What would happen to your employees and your ability to process all this information? Once we get an idea of what a technology does for us, we understand whether it's appropriate to buy a newer technology that might give us a little more of what we call leverage, or whether we should stick with the one that we have, or whether we need to be involved in the process of improving it. Consider early in your career, the work with exercise balls. Well, you're very famous for this, and there are some extraordinary pictures. I remember them because I show them to everyone, of you squatting on the exercise ball with an Olympic bar on your shoulders. And I say, you know, here's somebody who's clearly mastered this technology, and the exercise ball is not a very expensive technology, but because it is so versatile and so well understood in what you do, it gives great leverage to someone who wants to use that technology to become more fit or to rehabilitate some sort of an injury. Now we return to your original question. Where did that idea come from? It came from somebody's mind, and it went through some degree of refinement. For example, a lot of the early exercise balls, they were kind of gimmicky, and they were very thin. And people would attempt to do more aggressive exercise with them, and they'd break or blow up, and they'd get hurt. And the stuff that you sort of helped create was, you know, double the thickness or better and could really handle the load that people were putting on it. Those types of incremental improvements should not be ignored. And in the same way, when people sit down and they say, my life is disorganized or I'm not achieving what I want to achieve, they need to begin to look to what I would call a mind or a wisdom technology. They need to take a look at a process such as PPS, mastery, that can help them to say, okay, I see how to line these things up. There is a technology here. There's an ability to use this process and this process and this process to consider the four doctors and things like that and figure out how to use that to leverage my existence into an easier, more efficient, more effective, better, happier existence. But it really is all about technology. I mean, what you've created, Paul, is what we would call soft technology or method. And many of the things that I've worked with in my life revolve around hard technology or gear, as it were. And so we have this idea of applying some merger of technology and method. And one of the things that ties this into our larger theme here is that in Buddhist practice, there are two things. There are the ideas of method, and there are the ideas of creating an application of that method. So we have what we would call skillful means. And when you put these things together, you end up achieving greater control, greater happiness, greater benefit for others in your life. I know that's a very long answer, so if you want to ask me some more questions, feel free.
Yeah, well, you know, that's cool. It just highlights the reality that the inner technology is externalized. But, you know, one of the things that I try to pass on to my students is that if you overinvest yourself in external technologies, you run into a bit of a conundrum. And the conundrum is that everything that you externalize needs to be maintained. And when an individual is unable to successfully or skillfully maintain themselves as the source of technology, it's the equivalent of a mother who gives birth to a child that now needs to be loved, nourished, fed, educated, and guided for at least 18 years, but she takes up the practice of drinking, smoking, and doing drugs, and by the time the child is three, she's unfit and unable to, shall we say, manage the technology that she's internalized. So what happens is the result is that both technologies fail. The source of the technology and the technology itself now basically are in checkmate, and nobody wins, which leads directly into my next question. You know, you highlighted something in one of your articles that just, you know, made me giggle because it's something that I deal with constantly. And I in my library, I have books where Yogananda speaks of the same problem. I've got books where Steiner speaks of the same problem. And I've got books and audios where Osho highlights the same problem. And many other philosophers and teachers did as well. And that is the paradox that people seem to love perils. They seem to love them so much that they don't want to solve them, even when they say they want them solved, and they hire someone like me or you to solve them. They hire a guy like you because their systems are crashing and they lose huge amounts of data and have an absolute freak out. And you say, look, it's as simple as pressing this button right here that says back up. And I say, look, it's as simple as eating the right food, drinking water, getting to bed on time, and moving for, you know, what's as little as 20 minutes a day. Yet they will stand there and tell you why they didn't have time to back up or why they forgot to do that or why they didn't have a, you know, an effective power surge protector even though they spent $10,000 on a new software program. So I would love if you could share your perspective as what is it about human beings that makes them so desperately want to solve and not solve a problem at the same time?
You know, it's a wonderful question that you ask. And first, let's pay our respects to those many, many great philosophers, Steiner, Osho, Yogananda, people who have really spent a lot of time on the path looking for a truth that will be beneficial to everyone. I like to think of them as the applied philosophers, people who tried to bring it to the people instead of spending countless hours ruminating on it and producing perhaps a seminal document, but not really applying. And that's one of the things that makes a big difference and answers somewhat of your question. There's a big difference between knowledge and knowledge you've applied. Knowledge that you've applied suggests experiential understanding or wisdom. And so there are a lot of people out there in the world who are very, very smart. But that smartness, that knowledge has never really been applied. So they haven't wandered through the ups and the downs, the pitfalls of honing what it is that they know and making sure they can produce a result. And the thing that almost always creates that problem is something that Osho, Yogananda, Siddhartha, could tell you straight away. It's the ego. It's this concept of the difference between you and me, us and them. It's this question of how we preserve our internal identity. The instance that you described in the article that I wrote is a very prominent one, and I try to address that in an unusual way. I have a partner, Bennett Drozik, who is a remarkable, remarkable man, came to me with 3 degrees, political science, English literature, and so on, and you know, was not a hard scientist, and said, well, I want to learn how to do these things with computers so that I can help you and help these people. And so after several years, he became quite competent at computer troubleshooting and managing these things. But part of the role he plays in our business is as the distractor. When a client has a true crisis, the interesting part of it is they'll ask someone like me in, they will make a request, they will want you to care for them, and you will arrive, and they will point at the object, the technology that's broken or on fire, and then they will stand between you and that object. It's like one of those jokes where you have to kind of faint to the left and faint to the right and then run around them to fix the problem. Well, that became so time-consuming and so difficult, and I spent some time looking at the why of it. One of the reasons that I engaged Bennett in our business is for him to say, oh, hello there, and to distract them so I would be able to get around them and go put out the fire. Because in these instances, every moment counts. And so I can't really be the person who's engaging in extremely attentive, compassionate conversation with them while the whole system is melting down minute by minute. And that can really happen when you have hard drive failure and things like that. So we find a way to distract them. But when we look at the central cause of what's going on, it looks something like this. Most people don't like the fact that they don't understand technology. They think that they have enough intelligence and experience that they should, and so they're upset when they've got to call someone else to take care of it for them because they know it will be expensive, because they know it's a direct acknowledgement that they have a big problem they can't solve, and that in turn insults their ego. Another example of this was that the degree that I got used to be called human interface design. And the idea was that you would help create the way that someone would interact with the technology so that they could make it work for them. But one of the problems was in the early years of this particular pursuit that everyone else who was in the business of developing technology said, well, I'm human too, so what do I need your help for? They didn't realize that what we did in my business was collect tens of thousands of user perspectives about how people might want something to work. And this offended them. It offended their egos. So you'll notice now today that usability, human interface design doesn't exist anymore. It's now called usability engineering. That, too, was just a change to accommodate the egos of the people who might want to make use of this technology, where our goal is to help people understand how to make something more usable, more successful. Well, returning to the encounters that you're having with these clients, the difference here is that there are people who want to come to you so that they can be empowered, they can gain self-empowerment for change, and there are people who simply want to be cared for. There are people who are paying to receive care, as opposed to people who are paying to receive the knowledge and instructions for change. And the difference between the two, in most cases, is ego. In some cases, the people are so debilitated that they really do need care. They are particularly acute. But in the long run, we have to look at how they got there in order to figure out whether or not it was, you know, a congenital illness they had nothing, no responsibility for, or it was a series of habits, for example, burdening themselves with more technologies than they can take responsibility for. You know, there's an ability, the ability to say no is as powerful as the ability to say yes. And if we don't understand where to say no, we can't meet the PPS principle of I, we, and all, or self and other. One of the great Buddhist epithets in this is, how can you possibly expect to assist others if you can't sit still with yourself? And for those of us who have greatly compassionate intent, it's often very hard to not jump in and help someone else without first checking whether or not we're solid enough to do the job. Your heart goes out to them.
Yes.
And yet at the same time, you have to say, do I have what it takes? Do I have what is needed to engage this process at this time? There also is a big loss of reciprocity. in our world, especially with businesses. The way things have gone of late, there is very little understanding of how we become reciprocal with business, with loyalty, with an understanding. In my business in particular, Paul, there's very little thanks in the technology business, piteously little. We're in a situation where if we do the best job in the world and save them the most money of anyone they could pick, it's just good enough. But if anything, even the smallest thing happens to go wrong, to be honest, the shit has hit the fan.
Yeah.
And that is a very difficult and not necessarily particularly rewarding situation. It wasn't always this way. But there's a lot to the ego involvement. Most businesses don't want. I have had countless small business owners look at me and go, I hate computers. I wish we didn't have to use any of these things. Take them away. And the funny part of it is they don't realize that for people who do what we do at the network level, we could really just turn them off and then wait, see how long it takes before they, you know, go completely mad, which is usually somewhere on the order of 48 to 72 hours.
Yeah.
But they don't think about it themselves. There's not a consequence to it. So returning again to our central theme of where ego lies in this and so on and what is happening, when people come for help, it's an interesting thing to note about Buddhism as a religion as opposed to a practice or a spiritual endeavor. They're not evangelical. They don't come to you. Lamas don't come knocking on your door extolling the virtues of a particular practice of any sort. You go to them, and there's a reason for that. You need to be ready. They need to know that you have made up your mind that you need to go get some help from the Lama or from the spiritual practitioner, and that you're committed to gaining that help. And even so, even with that, there are many people who do show up who are not ready to do the work. You know, and making changes in PPS mastery is not instantaneous. You've got to receive the material. You have to receive the wisdom and the tools. You have to look at those tools and understand how to use them. You have to falter. You have to have a safe place to make mistakes as you learn to use them. And you have to have the patience and the persistence and the belief, the faith that they're going to benefit you. If you don't have all those things, not much is going to happen. And so in looking at this from that perspective, when you go back to the article and the example of the people, I've just employed what we would call a convenient adjunct. My partner distracts them so I can go in and I can pay direct attention to the problem. I can contact the vendors. I can either praise them or chastise them for sending us a bad product or not helping or, you know, attending to what they need to attend to and get the problem resolved as quickly as possible. And that's one of the things that does relate to looking at a long-term change in self. People don't change, generally, until the cost of changing is less than the cost of staying the same. And another way to look at that is to look at what the cost is. In most cases, that cost, the root of that cost, is suffering. So, funny thing about ego is that it causes us to maintain the same path. Better the devil you know than the devil you don't. Oh, my situation's not that bad. I know what I'm doing. I don't need any help. Well, this worked for me. Well, maybe it's not working for you now. But the point is, if you continue down that path, until the suffering of staying the same is so great, they probably won't undertake the path of change because it requires, well, effort. It requires looking at self, looking at ego, looking at concepts of mind, looking at habits, the source of habits. It requires a certain kind of mental housekeeping, a certain kind of spiritual housekeeping. Have I so overcommitted to the things in my life that I have nothing left to offer the people in my life? Have I so overcommitted to the programs, the things I participate in, my athletic pursuits, my habits, my proclivities, that I've lost sight of the whole reason that we're here? Our life on this planet is very brief. You know, the oldest woman just died recently, and she was 113 or something like that they had in the United States. In other countries, there are people who live to be quite a bit older, but even if you lived 125 years and you measured how good they all were, the fact of the matter is the time we get to spend with others is never as long as it could be. And it's probably best for us to really, really know what the technology is that's going to help us enhance and value and be reciprocal in those relationships. That's my thinking on the matter.
And that perfectly leads to the next question I have is, you know, when it comes to the issue of interdependence, you know, our Western mind seeks education under the guise of independence, which again is a quality of ego development, which is, you know, in my philosophy, a necessary phase, particularly for the first 21 years of a person's life, because if you don't know who you are, you don't know what you have to offer anybody else. What I would like to ask you, from your perspective and your work, personally, professionally, and spiritually, what I see a lot of people doing, most people doing, is they focus their lives around accomplishing for self, and even businesses do that. So, you know, a business may have a product or a service, but ultimately the owner of the business's goal is typically to get rich. And I know of many instances where people have made purchases of technology or changed the way they do things that made them more efficient, yet because of their lack of awareness of or knowledge of what we could call a science of interdependence, they ultimately produce a bottleneck effect. So some examples I'll give. People may buy a technology that allows them to produce a given product at three times the rate, yet before they bought the technology, they did not find out whether or not their suppliers were capable of supplying enough raw materials so that they could maintain that rate of production. And what ends up happening is the whole company comes into a state of collapse because they've sold X number of orders, but now they can only produce half those orders, even though they now have a much more advanced technology and what would look at the individual or company level as a more efficient system. But because their efficiency was not integrated with the efficiency of suppliers and even maybe shipping capacities, et cetera, they run into a lot of trouble. In my own life, one of my greatest gifts is also one of my biggest challenges, and that is that I have a mind that's capable of surveying massive amounts of information, sifting through it, and very quickly identifying what I would call the pearls. And then I string the pearls together to create a functional technology, like you mentioned, the Swiss ball. I could go on with all these different things, but one of the challenges that I have in my own business is that I can produce articles, books, audios, and videos literally nonstop. The amount of information, the amount of you know, just clear vision I have in my head, for whatever reason the universe put it there, is such that right now I have probably 11 books in press, but I cannot get them edited and produced fast enough because my own staff cannot even come close to keeping up with me. So I'm having to learn some pretty valuable lessons of interdependence. My question for you with that preamble is, are there systems, or is there a logical way that anybody could go through sort of a checklist and say, okay, before I buy this technology, this computer system, this, you know, widget manufacturing device, before I, you know, write 13 more books, are there layers of systems of, or is there, do you have some sort of a logical approach to assessing interdependence as a necessity of functional independence?
No, absolutely. And there are two points that I want to make about that. But before I do, if it's okay with you, I want to make sure I touch on one thing in our last question that you brought up that I did not speak about. Would that be okay?
Yeah.
You mentioned the idea of someone who has a child and then makes a series of other commitments, perhaps very unwise ones, and is no longer fit to raise the child. Well, one of the things that is clearly missed in our and many other societies is the questions we ask before we have a child. And in most instances, I'd say a great percentage of them, it's because having the child is considered, how should we say, a joyous accident. It wasn't necessarily planned.
Right.
You can't plan for children. I will tell you from a great deal of experience with a vast array of children and their developmental circumstances, something I pay particular attention to. If I had to do it all over again, I'd probably design parks, and I'd probably follow the path of Piaget in studying child development.
Mm-hmm.
Something that is very dear to my heart, very close to me, is this idea that you can plan for many things. But the funny part about ego and sufficiency and things like that is that if we can't plan for everything, it's what we call a 100% problem. There's a vast array of people who will plan for nothing because they can't plan for everything. I don't quite understand why that is, but I see it all the time. I see it when people undertake to undertake programs. For example, in the course of the Czech Institute, I introduced it to many friends of mine and physical therapists, and I said, why don't you teach this? You know, teach them three exercises here. You know, a month later, teach them three more. And the gentleman who I was dealing with said, no, I don't know enough. I said, you're a chiropractor. You have tons of knowledge. You don't have to master the entire area to bring benefit to people, but you have to be committed to expanding your mastery while enhancing their capability. Well, returning to the question of children and the circumstances that are involved there, for many people, when the children appear, it creates a break. I don't mean a good break. It's a place where the parents stop moving forward with their own development because now they have these responsibilities. It's a time to do, not to reflect. A time to answer the needs of the children, not to actually consider or think about what the right approach is. And it's led me in my life to a very different approach in working with technology and other things. It's what I call front-loading. I'm a firm believer that every process, or at least nearly all of them, is greatly benefited by doing all the homework up front, looking at the possibilities, looking at the permutations as well as you can. And there's an underlying reason for this in my practice. When one practices any good quality spiritual practice, you are encouraged to consider the consequences of your actions, in particular, the actions and the reactions that will occur in others around you. We're often, but not always, smart enough to make choices that benefit us. We rarely engage the time to consider how our choices will positively or negatively impact others. And in keeping that kind of thing in mind, we really look at how people make these decisions. So all of a sudden you've got kids, but how much time did you really think about raising them? It just happened. We've got plenty of time to now with the kids go do all these other things, but how much time do we think about preparing for what was knowingly going to happen? Let's take a concrete example. You have a baby. There's only certain things a baby is going to do. It's going to cry. It's going to eat. It's going to sleep. It's going to shit. And it's going to throw up. And the chances are good. In the course of that, with a few smiles and cooing in between, it may try to do them all at once. You know, one of the things that we forget, that we conveniently forget in rearing children, or in our own lives, in particular in our own lives, is that weird, very early period where the child is kick-starting its colon. And I don't want to be crass, but think about it. Put the image in your mind of a very young baby after it eats. Fits and starts and kicking and whining and turning bright red in the face and just agony. It's such a good thing that we don't remember that in one way. But when I look at little babies who are going through this, I'm like, God, all that work just to poop. You know, it's just brutal to watch that frame of reference. And the funny part is, if you know this about kids at that stage, you can prepare for 80% of what's going to happen. And most parents don't. You're a businessman. In the car, you put a bag. Every parent, including the modern male parent today, has been seen with the bag on the shoulder that's got the diapers and, you know, all the other things in it for the baby. But what about for the parent? The bag that has the extra tie and the extra shirt? Because chances are good, when you have that most important meeting and you're taking the baby to the daycare or whatever it is, the baby will sick up on your shirt or your tie or in your lap, or there will be some issue. Statistically speaking, Life understands that when our needs become most intense and our actions become the least precise, the largest number of accidents will happen. Another way to look at this as a sheer aside is, we used to say of copy machines that they had a need-sensitive circuit in them, and that if you came up to them in a great rush with a huge ream of paper that you need to be copied or you're going to lose your job, they'd feed like the first four sheets jam and you would be doomed. So what we tell administrative assistants is, when you come into the copy machine, kind of approach it sideways. Don't let it know you need the job. Just throw the papers in the hopper and walk away like you don't care, and the copy machine will copy everything perfectly. And they look at me and go, that really works. Well, it's a bit of an inside joke. But the reality is, when we are under stress, the reason that technology fails us, our computers fail, our copiers, other things fail, is because we are trying to commit a far higher number of actions per minute than we normally would. And then operator error comes into play. We accidentally type the wrong key. We accidentally delete the whole paragraph or the whole document or the whole page because we're going faster than the system can accommodate, or faster than we can accommodate at the right level of quality. So in concluding that aside, the way that you resolve these issues is that you try to engage enough upfront planning so that you don't put yourself in a jam. And some of that stuff is very, very simple. Couples work out the way everyone's done it. Honey, I don't want to be at this party anymore. Oh, I'm so sorry, we need to go. My wife is feeling a little unwell. Or, oh, we just got a call from the babysitter. There are a lot of different ways to manage those kinds of things, but there are other ways to implement them in our businesses, in our lives, in the relationships we have with our children. And that's where we're really losing out. So returning to, again, the idea I deviated from your last question, which is still in my mind, when parenting becomes a sudden event, when a parent passes away too soon, the transmission of knowledge and the experiences that need to happen aren't present for many of our parents. If our parents didn't have strong adult relations with their parents, it's pretty good to say that they're not going to know how to have communicative adult relationships with their own adult children. If parents became parents, as they did in the past, in the realm of the baby boom, when they were 18 or 19 or 20 years old, and they had only that much experience under their belt, if there wasn't a larger scale system of aunts, uncles, grandparents to continue the transmission of essential applicative wisdom, these people are winging it. And in the process of winging it with those children, there isn't a lot of time to learn, contemplate, or figure out what to do. Do you know that the most commitment in the course of the last 30 years that most parents have to parenting, if they didn't get it from their own parents, is reading Dr. Spock's book? I shouldn't say the last 30 years. I should say 30 years prior to that. And the mother read the book while she was gestating.
Yeah.
So there's I became pregnant, and I did 9 months of contemplation about how I was going to raise the child, and the biggest problem we have is figuring out what to name it. No. And then they planned the colors, and did they know it was a boy or a girl? Well, back then, you didn't know if it was a boy or a girl, so you had to figure out what you were going to paint the room. It wasn't, how am I going to deal with the situation when my child is influenced by bad outside influences? Perhaps drugs or alcohol or things like that. How am I going to consider all this stuff? Well, the bottom line is, and this is true for martial arts training, if you don't have a good engram, if you don't have a really good idea, well set and practiced in your head, when the event occurs, you're probably going to fuck up in the worst possible way. It is very unlikely that you are going to be able to do the right thing. So when we practice technology, and I do look at it as a practice, there are some rules that we apply, which are the same exact rules that you, Paul Check, and the Check Institute apply. Don't put to your client something that you have not thoroughly tested yourself. If I got to beat it with a hammer, I will beat it with a hammer, and I will take up any issues I find with the vendor long before that product will ever be released to our population, because we feel it is being unethical if you're to do that. But it also means that when we plan things for clients, new deployments and things like that, they often complain that we're kind of slow. Said, no, I'm creating a runway for you on which you can land a giant airplane. And when I'm sure I've got it all lined up, that plane's going to land perfectly. Now, in some instances, you don't have the luxury of that planning. And then you have to fly by the seat of your pants. But the problem with our culture, in the absence of its contemplative idea or pre-thought or front-loading, is that we think every situation should be fly by the seat of the pants. And the bottom line is most people don't have that ability. They don't have enough experience, they don't have enough reactivity in the right sense to be able to do the right thing in crisis situations. I have long ago, if somebody said, what do you do, Jerry Pape? I am a troubleshooter. People point at the trouble, and I shoot it. How do I do that? Well, it comes in the same way it works for you, and you mentioned it a little bit ago, Paul. You said you can synthesize amazing amounts of information and just pop out the nuggets of useful knowledge from them. If you are not familiar with, and I think you are, but if our listeners are not familiar with, I would so strongly recommend that they spend a few moments buying two books by Malcolm Gladwell, The Tipping Point and Blink. Blink talks about how, through our experiences and our internal capabilities, we have the ability to look at something and pull out the salient piece of information, how to know if a sculpture is really authentic or not with the glance of an eye if you're a skilled art dealer, how to know if someone is doing the right thing with their weightlifting or with their training practice or what have you. And I want to point out one thing about that. It's one of the greatest ego conflicts you will ever have. When someone comes to you, Paul, and you can tell in 30 seconds what's wrong with them, or one of the most major things that's wrong with them, they think you haven't listened to them. They believe it's impossible for you to know that quickly. And then they don't trust the advice they get because they don't feel that their ego has been appeased. They don't realize that the art form, as clearly described in Gladwell's book Blink, is something that people who are practitioners of certain things can do virtually instantly. My clients joke that when I walk in, all of a sudden the machine is working again, or I touch it and the problem has gone away. It's impossible. How did you do that? Well, there's a great story in technological management, one of the best. One of the great engineers from the Cray Computing Corporation in Minnesota, the first supercomputer corporation in the world, was called back in out of retirement to a client installation to fix a problem. He went into the situation, and he fixed the problem in something like 8 minutes. And he billed them his entire year's salary in one invoice. And they're like, well, you need to itemize what you did. And he wrote down on the return, the revised invoice, $10 for the part. And I'm paraphrasing here because I don't know the exact statistics. And $185,000 for knowing where to put it.
Exactly. Hey, Jerry, we're running out of time, so...
Let's move on to another question here, because I wasn't looking at the time. You were asking me about interdependence.
Yeah, I need Zen answers so we can, because I got a couple more important questions for you. So can you give me
I will be very brief.
The 1, 2, 3 of assessing interdependence.
Interdependence is the root, is the interesting part of where we all need to look at how we're going to move forward in a world that right now is really in an unusual state of crisis. A simple evaluation of the idea that the entire nation of Iceland has gone bankrupt. You know, a nation of 300 and some thousand people is pretty scary. We need to recognize, and this is something we do at Excalibur, and I know you do as well, Paul, that all of our clients are encouraged to know about, learn about, and do business with each other. We have to create the loops. We have to close the circular loops that keep people with compatible value structures working together and recognizing the benefit of dealing with each other. Because in the end, we are all the same being. We are all seeking an absence from suffering, and we are all looking for happiness. The problem is when we stop looking at how our actions affect others, we commit actions in the benefit of our own happiness that hurt people. And this is where we run into trouble in corporate America, the total absence of interdependence. Even though we're now globalized economies, and we're seeing the result of that, the corporation is not a person. And because it is not a person, it does not hold person status, it does not understand, in many instances, the absolutely essential nature of interdependence. A simple exercise for your listeners. Today, you're listening on a phone. At some point later on, you're going to take a look at a book. I want you to hold the book in your hand. I want you to look at the cover, the ink, the words, the paper, and I want you to think backwards through all of the time that it took to get that book into your hand. How it was printed, who cut the trees down, who created the ink, who typed it all up, who thought up the ideas that were in it, who jacketed it, the person who picked it up out of a box and put it on a shelf where you bought it. That's what you're really holding. That's the key to the Heart Sutra. It's the key to interdependence. No, everything is, it's just not what we think it is. So the next time you look at a person that you have difficulty with, or a situation you have difficulty with, do not think about the instant or the image or the appearance of that person. Try to look back all the way to the time at which they were just a glimmer in mommy and daddy's eye and beyond, because that's what they really are. It's all of those chronological events that creates the momentary composite thing in front of you, and that is especially true when we begin considering the consequences of our actions and what we commit to. Whether we overcommit to technology, we overcommit to our addictions, we overcommit to other things without realizing where the impacts and the effects are going to be. We need to be more careful about our front-end choices in order to succeed in a more complex world. The amount of information that the average child will handle from the ages of 2 years old to 10 years old is hundreds of thousands of times what it was in the age that you, Paul, and I grew up in. Our biggest input of information was PBS and Sesame Street.
Yeah.
And that had marked change on literacy and all kinds of other things in kids. Imagine what the Internet does. So there's a little thought on interdependence. What were your other questions?
Actually, I don't have time for them, Jerry. So what I'd like you to do is, if you could just, I've got 1.5 minutes before this is going to get cut off. So in 60 seconds, please offer the listeners what services they can use you as a mentor for.
I was approached when I was graduating from college from a variety of different organizations for one particular skill. It was a blink-oriented skill from Gladwell. It was the ability to take a look at any situation and very rapidly identify what resources were available to solve the problem, which resources were missing and required, and to create a plan for solving that problem. It's called tactical intelligence. It's a form of strategic planning that allows me to figure out what to do in almost any kind of crisis anywhere in the world faster than almost anyone else. If you have these kinds of problems, long or short term, and you need help in management strategy, technology, longer term spiritual thinking, regardless of what your religious pursuit is, I can probably point out a path that will be beneficial, but only beneficial to those who are willing to practice with persistence and understand that anything other than change is death. Staying the same is not what the world is all about.
Absolutely. How would you like people to contact you, Jerry? Your mentor information is going to be on the PPS site at the time this recording is being listened to, but would you like to just announce right now how to reach you?
Absolutely. They are welcome to email me at ppsmentor@est.com. Phonetically, that is E as in Echo, S as in Sierra, P as in Papa, T as in Tango.com. And they're welcome to email me at any time.
Fantastic. Well, Jerry, certainly lots of circular thinking and integrative thinking and awareness of challenges, and it's my dream that this interview gives people a chance for self-reflection so that they can truly understand that the term ego is really a misnomer, and to the degree that we all learn that our egos can only exist because other people allow us the impression of self, and that we can come to understand the importance of interdependence, I think everybody will do better with their personal, professional, and spiritual pursuits. So I'd really like to thank you for sharing, and I will save the other questions for our next interview.
If your listeners have an interest, I would love to speak with them, and you again. I thank you for this opportunity, and may all beings benefit from our endeavor.
All right. Thanks, Jerry. Have a lovely day.
You too.
Bye-bye.